From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and coming up, is marijuana addictive? We'll meet a student in Colorado who says it is for her.
But first, rescue workers are pumping oxygen into that capsized ferry off the coast of South Korea in the hopes of keeping any survivors alive. At least 20 are confirmed dead. Over 170 have been rescued, but more than 270 are still missing. And today, the ferry's captain apologized.
I am really sorry. I am deeply ashamed. I cannot put it into words.
Survivors say the captain didn't issue an evacuation order when the ship started listing, but instead asked passengers to put on life jackets and stay put. Captain Jade Staples is a master mariner in the U.S. Merchant Marine, 20 years of command experience. He's with Ocean River LLC Maritime Consultants. And Captain Jin, your thoughts on an evacuation order coming only after half an hour?
Yeah, this is of great concern to me. Why he wouldn't have done that initially, knowing that he had some major problems on board the ship, to where he couldn't correct the righting situation and bring her back to a normal, stable position. The command to evacuate should have been given probably within the first couple of minutes. I think in this situation, he would have known that right off.
Well, but the people have questions about that, and you're the one with the answers. We're reading in the Associated Press that his officers tried desperately to set the listing ship to, as you say, bring it upright as it was listing over. One crew member called in a distress call. This is all after the captain's first announcement when he asked people to put on life jackets but stay in place. Some have asked, well, if you are trying to right a listing ship, how could you put lifeboats over the side? Because either they will go into the water on the side that it's listing or they'll be pulled up out of the water on the other side.
Right. Well, what we have is the only way they could possibly try to right the vessel would have been to pump ballast. But given the fact that it looks like the cargo, the roll-on, roll-off cargo that they have, was not lashed to the deck, when you have a shift in cargo like this, you have a shift in the center of gravity of the vessel, and there's no way to correct that unless you've got equipment on board that can physically move these big tractor trucks and cars. So, you know, to be able to pump that amount of water in that quick of a time is probably almost impossible, and he should have known that. These ferries generally don't carry what we call a lifeboat. They don't have davits and lifeboats. They have what they call life rafts, and these life rafts can be deployed in two different ways. They can be physically lifted and thrown into the water, or they have what they call a hydrostatic release, that when the vessel sinks and gets to a certain depth, the hydrostatic release cuts the life raft free, and it floats to the surface and inflates. They definitely waited too long, and that should have been one of the first things they did, was to muster everybody and to get them into the life rafts immediately to get them away from that vessel, because it looked like a hopeless situation.
We know that there were at least dozens of cars in the bottom of this ship. There might have been cargo. There might have been tractor trailers, as you said. And you said that it wasn't lashed. Well, we've all been on ferries on the different coasts that we're on and traveling, and it's rare that they lash down the cars. You say what?
Yeah, that's very true. It is. It's very rare. And most of the ferries that we see here in the United States travel a very short distance, and they don't lash them because it would be futile to lash the vehicle down, and by the time they got there, they'd be unlashing them. So they need to maybe look at a different type of system to maybe just take these roll-on, roll-off vessels without passengers or only carry cargo on certain ferries rather than having this type of cargo on board a passenger ferry that carries 500 people.
Well, and in fact, this was an over 13-hour trip that these largely young people were on to a vacation island. And in that case, it sounds like you'd say they definitely should have lashed the vehicles.
Right. They definitely should have lashed the vehicles. But it sounds like that the vehicles probably were most likely not lashed down.
Yeah. We spoke to another expert who said that the fast rate at which the ferry sank might suggest, and again might, that watertight doors may have been left open. Your experience with that?
That's a very good possibility. That's one reason a vessel would go down very fast, is because the watertight compartmentation on board the vessel was not secure, which would mean that you would have a large area being filled with water that was not supposed to be filled with water. With the watertight compartments, the doors are closed, it would preclude any of the water from getting in there, which would hold the air buoyancy. The buoyancy of the vessel would help with the keeping the vessel stable.
Captain James Staples, master mariner in the U.S. Merchant Marine, 20 years experience, but also now with Ocean River LLC Maritime Consultants. Captain Jim, thank you.
Thanks so much, Robin.
Well, this week we've been looking at the new realities that have come with the legalization of recreational marijuana in Colorado. Those who opposed legalization warned that it would increase use among young people, and statistically it is too soon to tell if that is happening. What we do know is that only one out of six kids who tries pot becomes a heavy user. And today we're going to meet one of them, a student at Adams City High, just outside Denver, who started using marijuana long before it became legal in Colorado. She says she would like to stop, but is finding it tough to do so. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundin has the story.
Even sitting here with me, 17-year-old Janessa, who doesn't want her last name used, feels the craving.
It's the same as if your body's telling you that you're hungry, how your stomach growls. It just feels like I need to smoke weed. I'm craving it right now. Like, I can just feel it.
And her need for weed is easy to satisfy.
Now, today, because of the laws, it's insane how many people have weed, smoke weed, know where to get weed.
It wasn't always this way for Janessa. In school, she was always focused. She got straight A's. She hung out, she says, with the overachievers. But then, on her 13th birthday, her sister wanted to get her high.
And I was like, no. Like, I was such a good kid. That was never the choice. That, like, weed was never.
But she tried it to please her sister. It wasn't until she was 14, though, that she first got high. This time, it was a friend's older sister doing the offering. And every time they got together, there was pot.
I liked it.
Janessa dropped her overachieving friends for a new, cooler set. She worried that if she didn't smoke weed...
Not necessarily that nobody would like me, but I just liked being high. Like, I got used to seeing my face being high and how I looked being high. And it was just like the whole ritual. I just liked being like, all right, I'm going to wake up, I'm going to smoke some weed, I'm going to go to school, people are going to know that I'm high. Like, it seemed cool.
But more than feeling cool, the more she smoked, the more Janessa liked this. The feeling it gave her that nothing mattered. Weed was her shield from pressures at school and from arguments with her parents. Teenagers' brains are under construction. They're learning things like how to deal with stress and solve problems. When weed becomes the go-to, those skills are short-circuited. Like many kids who become heavy users, Janessa turned to weed to mask depression and anxiety, not realizing that she was making her situation worse. She'd stay up all night high sometimes, just listening to music, old school Tupac.
It's usually tied with the depression and stress, and I smoke to not feel that. It's not like I don't feel it later, it's just distracting.
Sophomore year, she was smoking all the time. To her amazement, she still made honor roll. But her habit did start affecting a sport she loved.
So there's me right there in the back.
As we walk through the school hallways, Janessa stops at a photo of her old varsity softball team. She was the catcher, a really good one. She's animated when she talks about the sport that's a big part of her family's life. She loved it.
And then that guy right there in the middle, that was my coach that I had talked to, and he was upset and stuff when I had quit. So, yeah, I've been on the team.
She smoked so much weed the summer before her junior year, she didn't practice at all. She thought she'd just jump back in the fall, but she couldn't.
And then that's when I was like, I'm really unmotivated. Like, I don't even want to play my favorite sport in the whole world, that the one thing that I loved since I was six. I'm really not playing that because of weed.
Then it started affecting her academics. She failed her first college class. Those were classes she was taking at high school for college credit. She ditched them to smoke weed. Talking about it now, it shocks her.
I was never like this. Like, what happened to me?
One day, Janessa left school grounds to go smoke weed. School cameras pick up who's leaving campus.
Right here. I walked in. And then
when she came back through the front doors, school security was waiting for her.
And they came out right here and just grabbed me.
At first, Janessa denied using, but finally, with her mom there, she fessed up. Instead of suspension, Janessa agreed to do Adams City High's 8-week treatment program. She dreaded going at first. She thought it would be like a weekend drug and alcohol class she had to go to once that didn't help her at all. But this was more individualized. She started to see the benefits from sessions with a therapist who was helping her to get in touch with thoughts that make her crave marijuana.
It's like there's a triangle. She told me that your thoughts become your feelings and your feelings become your behaviors.
Janessa tells Dr. Paula Riggs, who oversees the program, she's practicing flipping her negative thoughts and redirecting them into positive ones. Right now, they're working on different things she can do to keep her distracted, to fight the craving. One of those things is art class.
I could just sit here forever doing this.
She shows me her portraits, stunning pencil drawings. And then there's the roses.
I don't know. I'm just really obsessed with, like, roses for some reason, just because there are so many different ways that the flower folds and bends and, like, the shadows. And
she loves art so much she plans to study graphic design when she goes to college next year. Outside of art class, though, she's trying to think more deeply now about why she and her friends use weed. She's started observing her friends when they're not high.
They're all in bad moods, like their day's bad. It's never a good day if it doesn't involve weed.
That kind of awareness is part of the treatment program. It's helped her cut back on pot, but she hasn't been able to stop yet. She knows she needs to change, but the drug saps her motivation.
I know I'm addicted, so I feel like because of weed, like, I've not got stupider or dumber or nothing, but I'm just not as, I don't care. Like, I'm just tumbleweed in the wind. Well, if the wind blows me this way, I'll just have to figure out life this way. And that's what it did. And I'm pretty sure that's what it does to every other kid.
There's one kid in particular Janessa's hoping will stay away from pot, her 13-year-old brother. She tells him right now it might seem cool to do what everyone else is doing.
But down the road, like, when you're an adult, you're going to wish that you never, ever, ever picked up weed.
On that, her motivation seems infinite. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brendine in Denver.
And Robin, we've been hearing from a lot of listeners because of this week's series on marijuana from Colorado Public Radio.
Well, a lot of people saying, supporting it, but a lot of people saying, why are you paying so much more attention to this than, say, alcohol? We're going to address this, but we'd love to hear your thoughts at hereandnow.org.
You can also send us a tweet at Here and Now, at Jeremy Hobson, at Here and Now Robin. This is Here and Now. It's Here and Now, and as Robin said a moment ago, we've heard from many listeners this week who are unhappy with what they describe as one-sided coverage of marijuana. Some felt our story on a study linking casual pot use with brain abnormalities was alarmist, and according to one listener, a total buzzkill. So let's bring in a leading voice from the pro-decriminalization side of the debate, Ethan Nadelman, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, which campaigns to end the war on drugs. He joins us from New York City. Ethan, welcome.
Well, it's good to be on.
Well, you've heard some of our coverage. What do you think of it? Are we being alarmist at Here and Now?
NPR, I'd say, is better than most media outlets, but yes, you are being alarmist. I think that NPR, like other outlets, oftentimes plays into the inevitable biases in covering scientific coverage on drug use. For example, when multiple studies show no negative consequences from using a drug, those are not news. When one study, which has not been replicated involving a very small sample, does show some negative impact, then it becomes news. That's problematic.
But what about this week's series, which has been focused on kids using marijuana? Does it change, in your view, what the media can cover and what they should be asking when it comes to younger people rather than adults?
Well, obviously, one needs to coverage the issues of adolescent marijuana use differently than adult use or medical use or elderly use or what have you. I think that's obviously important. But it's also important in covering the issues of adolescent use to be realistic and honest and accurate, to be careful in how one describes causal relationships. When you go out and interview a student who say, I can buy marijuana everywhere, but fail to point out that teenagers have been saying that for 40 years and that, therefore, that teenager's comment is not a result of Colorado legalizing marijuana, I think that's a mistake. When you point out a study that talks about brain changes in young people but fail to point out that this study has not been replicated or that a person who uses two joints a day is described as a casual user, I think that's a mistake. So I think there's a lot of work to be done in providing more accurate coverage of adolescent marijuana use and of the scientific literature.
Well, we should say that groups and organizations, including the National Institutes of Health, say that marijuana is addictive. They say, contrary to common belief, marijuana is addictive. Estimates from research suggest that about 9% of users become addicted to marijuana. This number increases among those who start young.
Well, I'm sure that's right, but then it's worth asking, isn't everything addictive? What else is addictive at no more than a 9% rate? Are you comparing this to a whole range of other widely used substances or to beer or to coffee or anything like that or other sorts of activities? So put that number in perspective, right? Secondly, ask what's meant by addictive. Oftentimes, the government studies define a person who's addicted as a teenager who uses any marijuana at all, notwithstanding the fact that their life may be totally successful in every regard and that their drug use may cause no harm whatsoever. Also ask the question, to what extent is it a problem that the National Institute on Drug Abuse, National Institute on Mental Health fail to fund studies looking at the beneficial uses of marijuana, don't encourage studies that might show no significant negative impact for marijuana? Those sorts of biases and political influences, I haven't seen the coverage of those sorts of stories.
Well, one of the things that you have said is that there are people out there who are using this drug casually and they're not out about it, if you will. Nobody knows that they are, and that changes people's perceptions because they don't know that their friends are using it or whatever.
It's not so much friends. It's more the older generation. I think that the younger generation, by younger generation, I now mean age 16 to more or less 50 or 60, is more or less ignoring and writing off a lot of the reports that are now done about marijuana simply because it does not square with their own personal experience. I think the greater harm is done with the older generation of people who may not know people or don't think they know people who are using marijuana and are therefore most susceptible to being misled by these studies. You know, I sometimes say 50 years ago, everybody in America knew a homosexual. They just didn't know they knew a homosexual. And therefore, their image of who was a homosexual was shaped by dramatic media imagery or their fears or the most outrageous people. Now everybody in America knows a homosexual, a gay person, and they're ordinary people. And therefore, the extremes or the most dramatic or the most fearful don't represent the typical image. Well, similarly, everybody in America up to age 100 knows people who use marijuana, but most of them don't know they know somebody who uses marijuana. Therefore, their image of the adolescent marijuana user is the one getting in trouble in school, the one misusing it, the one being reckless. The marijuana user who's 17 or 18, doing perfectly well in school, on the sports teams, going to a good college, they don't know about that because that youngster is being responsible and they're hiding what they do, both from the media and from older people.
Ethan, do you have children?
Yes, I do.
Do you smoke in front of them?
You know, I've made an agreement with my daughter, who's now 25, that we won't talk about our own personal experience with this. But what I can say is that throughout, I've talked to my daughter about marijuana the same way I would about alcohol and other substances. I've talked to her about the relative risks and dangers, what responsible and irresponsible use means with marijuana, alcohol, or other drugs. I let her know that if she started smoking cigarettes, I'd kill her. So, I think what's happened is a whole generation of parents, most of whom smoked marijuana when they were younger, most of whom had friends who smoked marijuana, many of whom still do. There's a much more honest dialogue now that's going on between adolescents and their parents. And I think that's leading to a much healthier environment.
Ethan Nadelman, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, which campaigns to end the war on drugs. Ethan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Today is another big election day in the world's biggest democracy. In fact, in terms of seats in parliament, it's actually the biggest day because 122 seats are up for grabs. The governing Congress party is facing a strong challenge from the Hindu nationalist BJP in India. The BBC's Sanjay Manjumda reports from Rajasthan, one of the states that is voting today.
The village of Rajnota is just off the main Jaipur-Delhi highway, about 15 kilometers past a bumpy road. And we've just driven past the fields where you can see a lot of women working hard under the midday sun, dressed in colorful saris and veiled. This is conservative country. Now in the village square, there are quite a few people around. Some are smoking a pipe, others reading the newspaper. The village itself is still fairly underdeveloped, but politically, everyone here is very aware.
There are no jobs here. Delhi is 250, 300 kilometers away, and Mumbai is even further. It's too far for our children to go looking for work.
The politicians just lie to us all the time. In 10 years, no one has built a road or a hospital.
I don't even have a proper roof in my house. When it starts raining, I'm going to be washed away.
Rajasthan sends 25 MPs to the Lok Sabha, the lower house of India's parliament. It's not as big as some of the other states, but it's still crucial politically because it's a swing state. People here tend to vote en masse for one party over the other. That's why the BJP, the opposition party, and the incumbent Congress have been working hard on the voters, who, as we've seen, are politically savvy.
Checking in with the BBC's Sanjay Majumdar in India during that country's ongoing election. This is Here and Now. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General Mills, the company that makes everything from Cheerios and Wheaties to Green Giant frozen vegetables and Yoplait yogurt, has changed its privacy policy. The new terms warn consumers that they give up certain rights to sue the company if they download General Mills coupons or enter a company sweepstakes or even like the company on Facebook. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Derek, tell us more. I mean, they say that in order to have a settled dispute with a company after doing anything like buying buying something with a coupon, you have to do it through binding arbitration. You can't sue?
You cannot sue. General Mills, as you said, is a food megacorp. You may eat it every single day. It owns Betty Crocker, Nature Valley, Pillsbury, basically every sweet cereal you ate and serve your kids, Golden Grahams, Cheerios, Cocoa Puffs. But the startling new legal policy does make it illegal to sue the company after you download or print a coupon, join an online community. It's not entirely clear which online communities, subscribe to an email newsletter, redeem a promotion, maybe even simply buy a product. It now says that all of these disputes are resolved through binding arbitration. You cannot sue. You cannot join a class action suit.
They seem to be saying, if you've taken one of our benefits, then you can't sue us. But if you go to the General Mills webpage and you look at the cover story, or the cover page, rather, for the legal terms, it seems to be implying, and I'll read the sentence, this includes disputes related to the purchase or use of any General Mills product or service. In other words, they're saying it's not just the premiums, it's if you outright buy a product. Are they saying that if you get a box of cereal and it has a screw in it and you break your tooth, you can't sue?
You can't sue. No, you can't have a class action lawsuit. It goes through binding arbitration. I pulled out that exact same sentence. I was going to read it as well. It's really astonishing to require that all disputes related to the purchase or use of any product has to be resolved through binding arbitration. So what is binding arbitration? Mm-hmm. That means that disputes are resolved outside of court. And outside of court means that the parties give up their right to sue, to participate in a class action, or to appeal the arbitration decision. So essentially, bottom line, it means that the balance of power is tipped overwhelmingly toward the corporation, in this case, General Mills.
Yeah, but this is just General Mills saying this. does that hold up? Will that hold up in court, that they declare that you can't sue them, even if their product is defective?
It's a remarkable claim. It's not entirely clear whether it will hold up in court. On the one hand, a recent Supreme Court decision in 2011 gives companies significantly more latitude to do just this, to prohibit class action arbitration with these new legal terms. But legal experts say that General Mills is going to have to find some way to prove that customers knew about this new policy in order to enforce it. And it's not entirely clear that moms and dads across the country are checking out GeneralMills.com before buying their kid Cocoa Puffs or Cheerios. And so there are legal experts that were interviewed by the New York Times when they broke the story this morning that said that this is the first case they've seen of a food company of General Mills scale moving in this direction. It's possible that others will follow if it holds up in court. But it's also possible that this new legal rule is simply too sweeping and that it will not hold up in court.
Oh, no, Derek, you and I might have to go to court because they may claim that we told people, and so they should know.
I know.
We should say you can opt out of this policy after buying a product if you write an email to General Mills saying you want out, but that doesn't cover you for the time period before you opted out. Boy, Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thanks as always, Derek.
Thank you.
You're listening to Here and Now.
This is Here and Now. There are now more than 17,000 signatures on a new White House petition calling on the Obama administration to reconsider new Army regulations about hair and grooming for men and women. The new rules, called AR-671, tighten the restrictions on how women can braid and twist their hair, which has drawn criticism from some African-American women in the military and from the women in the Congressional Black Caucus, who have sent a letter to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel asking him to reconsider the new regulations. Joining us from NPR West is Karen Grigsby Bates. She reports for NPR's Code Switch team, which covers race, ethnicity, and culture. Karen, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, we want to get to some of the criticism, but first, just explain these new regulations. What do they say exactly, and what's the rationale behind them?
Well, they're basically an update of some things that had been on the books before that they decided to tighten up a little bit, I think. And the thing that has caught public attention so much is the reaction of Black women who have natural hair to the styles that now are allowed because of this new Army or this updated Army regulation. The things that are no longer allowed are things like big twists, multiple braids, anything larger than a quarter of an inch, which if people are listening and they can think about what the tip of an eraser looks like, that's just about a quarter of an inch wide. Fancy headbands, dreadlocks, anything with decoration. So if you had, even if you had regulation size braids, but they had beads at the end, no, can't do that.
But we think of the military as a place where you do have to abide by whatever the regulations. You see men walking around with these buzz cuts. Why is this causing such an uproar?
It's causing an uproar because women of color who wear their hair natural feel that they have been singled out, that the law actually applies to everybody. But if you don't have kinky hair, then it kind of doesn't affect you and it doesn't matter. Hmm. And what they're saying is we have chosen to wear our hair without straighteners, either chemical straighteners or straightening comb or flat iron, whatever, because we feel it's comfortable and it's healthy and we're being made to feel different and to a certain degree put upon by these constrictions, that our hair grows differently. It grows out, not down. That the Army way of saying, well, if you have long hair and you want to keep it, then you have to be able to put it up in a bun that's above your collar. We'll accept that. They say, you know, with our kind of hair, that doesn't work. So they feel that there's been some cultural insensitivity to their daily reality.
And what's the military said about why they did this in the first place then?
Well, the military says basically we're doing this for two reasons. For safety, you know, your helmet needs to fit properly on your head in case something happens. They're also saying, hello, it's the Army. They call them uniforms for a reason. We want everybody to look relatively the same way. You can be an individual in your off hours, but if you're agreeing to come into our environment and to be part of this organization, then we expect you to look a certain way.
And Sergeant Jasmine Jacobs of the Georgia National Guard told the Army Times that she's been in the military for 6 years. She's worn her hair natural for much of that time, and it's never interfered with her headgear. So there are plenty of people making the argument that this is not necessary, these regulations. What's the penalty for not following the rules?
Well, I just got a note from Lieutenant Colonel Elaine Conway, who I've been talking with back and forth about this whole business, and she said that soldiers who violate AR 671 may be subject to adverse administrative action, such as counseling or a written reprimand, and they could face charges under Article 92 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So a soldier could face disciplinary action ranging from non-judicial punishment to a court-martial.
Karen, we mentioned that the Congressional Black Caucus has sent this letter to Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Has there been a response?
There has not yet. And, Jeremy, it was a pretty tough letter. Representative Marsha Fudge, who's a Democrat from Ohio and who's currently head of the Congressional Black Caucus, was the principal signatory. And she basically said that while she understood the intent of the upgraded regulations to ensure military uniformity, quote, it seems as discriminatory rules targeting soldiers who are women of color with little regard to what is needed to maintain their natural hair. Fudge also said that she had personally heard Army personnel refer to natural hair in derogatory terms that they called natural hair matted and unkempt. And it seems that she feels that that's a value judgment that was based on racial perception of what, quote unquote, good hair should look like.
And is there a larger context here, Karen, about how the Army's relationship with people of color is in general right now?
I think the Army is pretty proud of itself, and it's been lauded considerably for its aggressive outreach to communities of color to say, you know, come work with us. We can give you a skill. We want all of America to help in serving the country, which all of America has been doing for a while, although if you go back to World War II and certainly before then, not always welcomed with open arms. Mm. You realize that the Army was segregated until 1948, and right. So people of color were often swabbing decks if they were in the Navy or hosing oil up off of the tarmac if they were in the Air Force. That has changed radically over the past several decades to the point where now many sociologists point to the Army as a institution that has encouraged people of color to excel far more than its civilian counterparts. And in fact, the Army likes to say often that there's more opportunity within it for people of color than it is for many Fortune 500 companies. So the implications for this, when something like this pops up that says you are being discriminatory toward women of color, puts a little dent in that. And I think what black women who are upset with the updating of the regulations, black women with unstraightened hair, are saying that they should be able to wear their natural hair natural and neat. And if when they're not allowed to, it makes them feel as if they're not able to rise to their full potential or, to use an old Army recruiting slogan, to be all that they can be.
NPR's Karen Grigsby-Bates from the Code Switch team, which covers race, ethnicity, and culture. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And some other stories we're following today. Israel has been largely silent about Russia's intervention in Ukraine. The tiny country with a Russian Jewish foreign minister seems to want to preserve its good relations with Moscow. Also, as the drought in California persists, the parched region of the Central Valley is seeing some unlikely political alliances forming as farmers pressure the federal government to help solve the water crisis. We'll have details on these and other stories later today on All Things Considered. You're listening to Here and Now.
Primatologist Jane Goodall, perhaps one of the great field researchers of all time, known for her meticulous study of the Gombe chimpanzees in Africa, had to be reminded of a hard lesson with her 2013 book, Seeds of Hope. You're nothing but your notes. The book had to be pulled after it was pointed out that several passages were from websites. Now, Jane said she realized that in her notebooks, she'd often failed to distinguish between something she'd read and something she was told in an interview. Well, thankfully, the book has now been re-released because it is a treasure trove of stories that now have 57 pages of footnotes. Her plea for the plant world, from the secret trees that are thousands of years old to seeds hundreds of years old, including some stored in vaults carved in the side of a mountain on a remote island in Norway. The first botanists are here. They come off like Indiana Jones. There are foresters. One planted 26 trillion trees in his lifetime. And always, Jane's love of the plant world sparked as a child in England. And Jane Goodall joins us to talk about all of it from the studios of NPR in New York. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
And let's just address the borrowing. What happened?
You know, I wasn't paying enough attention to this. But, you know, I have to write my books between this crazy 300 days a year on the road. And I'm not terribly organized. But, you know, I'm actually really, really glad, looking back, because the book is much better now, and I was able to add some fantastic new material.
Well, it's how you view what's happening to plants around the world, but it's also part memoir. So just take us back there first to your love of plants and trees, especially since, as you point out, wait, you're the chimp lady.
Yeah, I'm the chimp lady, yes. Well, you know, my love of trees and plants began when I was a child. Growing up, we still have the house, and I love to climb my favorite tree in the garden, beech, who's still there now.
And you also demanded that your grandmother give it to you at one point. So there's a picture of the contract she wrote up giving you the tree.
Yeah, well, actually, I wrote it, and she signed it, and my mother kept it. So it's a very precious little document.
But what does that mean to you? You talk of feeling a special presence around trees. There's so many moments, leaning your cheek against them. What does that mean that tree is there?
Well, to me, trees are living beings, and they have their own sort of personalities. I'm not being scientific here. I'm just talking about the way it feels. There are the young, eager saplings, all striving with each other to get up above the canopy so that their leaves can get the full benefit of the sun. And if you put your cheek against one of those, you almost sense the sap rising and the sort of energy of that young tree. And then you get these incredible ancient beings who've, well, some of them have been on the earth for 2,000 years. And think what they've seen. You know, I've been in the redwoods in California, and I don't know, I just absolutely love trees.
You speak of your love of trees in an unscientific way, but you write about the science that is being gathered, that trees do communicate with each other, for instance.
I remember hearing about it when I was in one of the universities. If this tree is attacked by a horde of caterpillars, it puts out special chemical signals like pheromones, and then nearby trees of that species will add additional toxin to their leaves so that if they're invaded by the caterpillars, they have a better chance of withstanding them. Other trees communicate deep under the ground with little thread-like fungi on their root systems. It's even thought that an entire forest may be interconnected under the ground.
Well, David Rhodes is one of the scientists at the University of Washington who is part of this research in plant tree communication. There's another research team from Ben-Gurion University in Israel. They also talk about plants communicating. For instance, domestic pea plants that had terrible drought would alert somehow, nobody's quite sure, but maybe through the root systems would alert other plants. And what would the other plants do?
They adopt all the tactics that the drought peas adopt to prevent water loss. But then what's even just as fascinating is that when these plants who have learned how to react to drought are compared in drought conditions with a naive group of peas, those who've already learned how to react survive better.
You know, it's quite something, Jane Goodall, to read about your love, not only your love of, but now your knowledge of the plant world, and then to contrast that with young people that you've met. You started an organization, Roots and Shoots. It's around the world so that young people can start having the same experience. And yet we hear of a young girl in a prison. The prison starts to work with gardening for these young female inmates. And this young girl wonders if you can plant candy corn.
Yes.
I mean, there's such a distance between your knowledge and the knowledge today.
Well, and, you know, we really hope through this youth program that we can get a better understanding of the natural world. You know, one of the main emphasis is taking action. So choose a project that will help the environment. Choose a project that will help animals. Choose a project that will help people. And in that way, the young people learn the interconnection.
Well, there's a whole list to choose from. You catalog them, some of the things you are concerned about. There's the shrinking forests around the sanctuaries where you have some of your animals, chimpanzees.
What happened to me was a flight over Gombe National Park, which is very tiny. It's only 30 square miles. I knew there was deforestation outside the park, but I wasn't prepared to look down and see outside this oasis were bare hills. More people living there than the land could support. And so that's when I realized we can't even try to save the chimps and their forest if we don't improve the lifestyles of people. So we began working with the local villagers. And in the end, the villagers got together and put land aside in such a way that it forms a buffer around Gombe. And we also train forest monitors. So they take, it's very funny to think of people in remote villages using Android tablets, but that's what they're doing.
That's fascinating. They go around the forest, and what do they do on these tablets?
Well, if they find some place where a tree has been illegally cut or an animal has been shot, they press a little button, and this information flies up into these magical clouds that I hear about and is accessible, if anybody wants, all over the world.
Well, and you also tell the stories of heroic trees. There's no other way to put it. Trees that make themselves the symbol of why they should be saved. There's the one that survived the attack on the World Trade Center.
Well, I think the lovely thing about that story is that and it was on its way to the dump. And then somebody said, look, it's still alive. We must give it a chance. And they nurtured it and nurtured it. It was nearly killed by Hurricane Sandy and rescued again and finally taken back to Ground Zero. And it's now a beaut. I mean, everybody should go. And the tree is called Survivor. I've met her. She's beautiful.
You've been traveling, carrying this message. Do you feel, a responsibility? You just are nonstop. What propels you?
Well, I think, you know, we come into this life with certain gifts. One of the gifts I was given was communication, so that, you know, people come to my lectures and listen, and they buy the books. And so that power of communication is something I feel it's really important to make the very maximum use I can. And as I get older, you know, I've just turned 80, so obviously I'm getting closer to the time when I will no longer be here, maybe joining all these messages up on the clouds, I don't know. But anyway, you know, it becomes even more urgent.
Jane Goodall, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And at HereNow.org, we'll link you to Jane's appearance this week on the Colbert Report. As Stephen said, she discovered chimps use tools, and yet it's illegal to have one build your deck. Her book is Seeds of Hope. It's written with Gail Hudson. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It is so great to hear from Jane Goodall on this program today. This is Here and Now.